Welcome, Doctor.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Gary Mims, and I appear on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Chapel Brooks. It's my hope I can reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This comes on two issues. One is a jury instruction, and one is the answering of a question by the trial judge. I'll take the jury instruction first. This is Model Jury Instruction 35.040. This instruction reads, and I quote, "The fact that a doctor's efforts on behalf of his patient were unsuccessful does not by itself establish negligence." It's our position that this is not an instruction at all. It's just a statement of fact. It does not assist the jury in any way, does not explain the law applicable to the case, or aid the jury in arriving at a proper verdict. That's what this court said should happen in Kane versus Lee.
Doesn't the instruction simply say something that's nonetheless obvious but true, which is we don't want juries inferring negligence simply because something bad happened? And it's a natural human tendency. It's in the emotions of all of us. What's so wrong about repeating something that we all know to be true?
It's incomplete, and it's argumentative. It focuses on the efforts of the doctor when the plaintiff's theory was not only the efforts of the doctor, but the omissions of the doctor. As this court held in Nelms versus Nelms, it's a reversible error for a trial judge to single out for emphasis a part of the evidence tending to establish a particular fact. Our case, as you know, Your Honor, was that the doctor erred in failing to use neuromonitoring during the procedure to take away pain from the spine. It wasn't an effort to cure that pain.
So that this instruction could be fixed if it said efforts or omissions, conditions or omissions.
I think the instruction would be better and would be in more conformity with the prior instruction that this court has approved if it said the outcome versus efforts. I think it, because it wouldn't focus on a particular act or a particular set of acts, it would say merely because the plaintiff was injured doesn't allow you to infer negligence. That would be better, but it would not be complete. The genesis of this instruction, if you look at the commentary in the model jury instruction, was Brown versus Koulouzakis. And in Brown versus Koulouzakis, the court wasn't dealing with a jury instruction. The court was dealing with a statement of law, what the burden of proof on the plaintiff was. What was important in Brown versus Koulouzakis is, after stating that the mere fact that the defendant has failed in its effort to effect a cure, that does not raise a presumption of negligence, the court went on to say, nevertheless, a physician must demonstrate that degree of skill and diligence in the diagnosis and treatment of the patient employed by a reasonably prudent practitioner in his field.
Well, don't your finding instructions say that obvious point as well?
Well, my finding instructions do say that, but there are 20 instructions that were given in this case, excluding the one at issue. 25% of those instructions, 5 of those instructions, talk about the plaintiff's burden of proof. And the plaintiff has the burden of proof, negligence, 25% of the time. Then we have an instruction that's just a fact. It's no different than having an instruction. If the plaintiff had moved for an instruction and said, merely because Dr. Nguyen graduated from Harvard Medical School, does not mean that he knows the standard of care or that he practiced in conformity of the standard of care. That would be a fact. And in almost every case we have, defendants put on evidence, even though they're experts not testifying as an expert witness, about the fact that he went to medical school, he graduated with high honors, something that's not relevant to the issue. It would be a fact that doesn't mean he practiced in conformity with the standard of care. But it would be inappropriate because it's singling out an issue in the case that is not definitive. This instruction doesn't help the jury determine anything.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
If I recall correctly from the amicus brief, there's 27 states that have some version of this. Is that right?
There
And so that, to me, suggests that a majority of states have seen fit to have some version of this. Are there any that you would commend to our attention of the many that you think would state this principle in a more balanced way?
Well, Maryland has a similar instruction. Maryland's instruction reads, and I quote, "The mere happening of a bad result does not create a presumption of negligence, but can be considered as evidence of negligence." That's a much more fair instruction. It's well-rounded. It has a second half. And again, it goes to the result. It doesn't go to the effort of the doctor. This instruction allows the doctor to say, allows the jury to come back and go, wait, during this particular procedure, which was the implantation of a neurostimulator, during this particular procedure, if he used his best efforts, then that's not evidence of negligence. But what makes this more difficult is, and I'm going to end up moving to my second part of the case.
Well, before you do that, let me ask you about the Maryland instruction. You think that a bad outcome, while it's not a presumption or a lack of presumption of negligence, is evidence of negligence? So you could go to the jury and say, look, I'm going to explain this in a more complicated fashion through my expert, but something bad happened. And you can take that with other information and conclude that the bad thing that happened is evidence of negligence. I thought that's exactly opposite of the legal principle.
Well, in Hunter versus Burroughs, this court allowed that. This court granted an instruction that was the subject of the appeal. And this court affirmed the instruction, which reads, and I'll read it. The court instructs the jury that the fact that after the plaintiff was treated with the X-ray by the defendant, ulcers appeared in his legs, does not of itself alone entitle the plaintiff to recover. And the jury are instructed that they shall find for the defendant unless the plaintiff is shown by a preponderance of the evidence that the ulcers were caused by the negligence of the defendant or his lack of skill or his failure to apply the same.
Well, that's just coupling the finding instruction with the accident doesn't equal negligence.
But the instruction, this is the instruction the court tendered after granting a plaintiff's instruction that said the jury, that the fact of an injury was some evidence of negligence.
Well, read that instruction then.
Pardon me?
Read the instruction you say that said that. That's the curious one. Don't let me mess up your argument. Come on back. Finish your argument. It's not that important.
Okay. But the point is that to your question that the fact that there is an injury can be some evidence of negligence.
It's evidence of damages. It's not evidence of negligence.
This instruction or a type of instruction like this might be appropriate if the plaintiff's expert testified that this does not happen absent negligence. If some testimony like that had come into evidence, perhaps a curative instruction similar to this would be appropriate, but it needs to have the other language. And every instruction that this court has condoned on this issue, which actually is only one, has the language that couples with the you can't make a presumption, but the defendant has the burden. But if the defendant proves negligence, he's entitled to recover. It's a complete statement of the law, not a simple part of the law. What makes this difficult, and it ties into the issue of the jury question in this case. Our evidence in this case was that Dr. Nguyen was negligent in failing to use neuromonitoring, which allowed him to miss the fact that he contused his spinal cord. So he was unable to treat it. Dr. Nguyen left the hospital. Dr. Nguyen got a call from the PACU that said the patient's legs she can't move her legs. He said, take her off of her drugs to make sure that's not interfering with her ability. And he said, do a CT to rule out a hematoma, because a hematoma would explain pressure on the cord causing numbness, the inability to use legs. And that's all he did. In this particular case, if the jury is focused on the efforts given by the doctor, and our evidence in the case was the surgery he performed wasn't negligently performed, and the CT that he ordered wasn't negligent to order that was appropriate, those efforts of the doctor did not deviate from the standard of care. But it prevented the jury from going further. So the jury's told by this instruction, M, that the fact that doctors' efforts do not, and there's an unsuccessful outcome, does not establish negligence. The jury's focused on efforts. The jury in this case came back with a question and said, wait a minute, are we allowed to consider up to the day that the patient stayed in the hospital for 6 days? The jury's question was, is there a limited time frame to which we should limit our considerations of negligence? If so, when? For example, from February through August, August was the date the doctor last saw the patient, or from the date of surgery to the time of discharge from the hospital 6 days later. The jury wanted to know if they were bound to stick with the efforts that the doctor had given on the 20th, or if they could look beyond that.
Did your expert testify about deviation of standard of care on any date other than the date of surgery?
Yes, ma'am. At page 1143 of the appendix, Dr. Barla, question, do you have an opinion as to whether or not Dr. Nguyen, with regard to the surgery that he performed on February 19 of 2010 and his follow-up treatment thereafter, met the standard of a reasonably prudent neurosurgeon under similar circumstances in Virginia? Answer, I do. Question, what is that opinion? Answer, that he did not meet those standards. And it, so it included follow-up. And then we went on.
What was the evidence
about the follow-up?
I'm sorry. I think it was the same question.
I think it was, too. And I think I know what the question is. What was the follow-up? The follow-up was that Dr. Barla testified that a CT will not show compression of the cord. All a CT would show is whether there was hematoma that might be causing the compression, because that's the most likely thing that's going to happen during this kind of surgery, is that you're going to... Once the CT ruled out hematoma, it was and the patient continued to deteriorate while in the PACU and in the hospital, he should have done something more. He should have done an MRI. He should have taken out the electrode so he could have done an MRI. Or he should have done a CT myelogram. And as Dr. Barlett testified, a CT myelogram would actually demonstrate what was causing this progressive decline. This doctor didn't do anything.
Where can you point me in the transcript as to where the jury would have drawn a conclusion or the jury could have found that those things should have been done on a day other than the surgery? The performance of the CT myelogram. As I read your expert's testimony, he doesn't say how long after the surgery that could have taken place. So was the jury to conclude it would have been on that day or within the 6 days that she remained in the hospital? What evidence would they have relied on?
Well, the evidence would be, because he did show an MRI that was taken much later on that showed the cord compression, the evidence would have been that once he did the CT myelogram, which was done late in the afternoon on the day of the surgery, and it ruled this out, he should have done something more. Whether that could have been done the 20th, or any of the 6 days the patient remained in the hospital, something should have been done to find out why this patient couldn't use her legs. And we didn't have, Dr. Barlett didn't say it needed to be done on the 20th, didn't say it needed to be done on the 21st.
Did he say there was a window of hours in which you would have found the damage if you had done the CT myelogram?
He said there was a window of time.
A window of hours?
I don't think he said there's a window of hours to do the CT myelogram. I think he was talking about there's a window of hours within which a steroids could have been given to affect the swelling of the cord. But our evidence was that this patient was paralyzed when she came out of the surgery. The defense evidence was this patient's condition was progressive. If they took the defendant's theory of the case, that she progressively got worse, then that clearly tells you the only reason she's getting worse is there's increased pressure on the spinal cord. And with the increased pressure on the spinal cord, something was going on that was causing this. What happens is once the cord gets compressed so much, it becomes ischemic and it dies. So you lose the ability to use your legs or from that point down. So at this point in time, when the cord is being compressed, if the defense is right in their evidence that she was getting worse during this period of time or her condition wasn't stagnant, then something was going on. The jury clearly could have inferred that this test could have been done at any particular time during this period. The fact that he didn't do the test doesn't doesn't give them the right to assume that had the test been done, it would have been negative. We're saying it should have been done.
Well, but your complaint says it was the manner in which defendant performed the surgical procedures that deviated from the standard of care.
Well, I think the complaint goes on beyond that. This complaint, which I should have memorized, but it wasn't, I didn't draft the complaint. My recollection is that this complaint says on or about February 19, the defendant was admitted to the hospital. And then paragraph 4 says the defendant was guilty of negligence and deviated from the standard of care in his treatment of the patient. It goes on to talk about, in paragraph 6, the manner in which he performed the procedures. It talks about, in paragraph 5, informed consent. And then it talks about, in paragraph 7, this is not artful, it says, as a direct result of the defendant's negligent deviations from the standard of care and failure to obtain informed consent, the plaintiff has suffered this. So it's a continuum. My problem...
Has he answered your question?
Yes.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Mike Oshesky, and together with Ben Wengert, we represent Dr. Nguyen. I'd like to first address the jury instruction M. That jury instruction was properly given. It was not an abuse of discretion because it is a clear, succinct, accurate statement of the law supported by the facts in the case. I'd like to first mention that it has widespread use in Virginia, as well as I think the court has already recognized from the BTLA brief, there are at least 29 other states that have model instructions like it. So there's apparently widespread use in the country on this principle of law.
Let me just tell you the two things that concern me that maybe you can help me with. One is this the wording of effort in a situation where, and in other cases it might even be more stark than this, where it's the idea that the negligence was a failure to do certain things. And the second thing is, should it be balanced, as a number of states have done, within a countervailing statement however it's worded, you know, we just heard from the Maryland one as an example. So should it be balanced and should we redact effort?
Well, so I'll first speak to effort. It's my belief that the purpose of the instruction is to help the jury understand the sufficiency of evidence on negligence. So, when we look at the instruction for negligence, instruction L, we're looking at an instruction that tells that the jury is told a doctor has a duty to use the degree of skill and diligence in the care and treatment of his patient that a reasonably prudent doctor would have used in the circumstances. Skill and diligence is what the jury instruction on negligence specifically states. And I know it's a statute as well, I understand this, but we're focusing on the definition of negligence in a malpractice case on the skill and diligence exercised by the defendant. This instruction, talking about efforts, is doing the exact same thing. It is the defendant's effort in utilizing and employing his skill and diligence, just as that instruction indicates, and it's instructing the jury...
But it might be something other than effort.
Meaning the absence of effort?
Could be the absence of effort. It could be I should have told someone to do something and I neglected to, or as you say in the Episcopal Church, sins of omission and commission.
Precisely.
And efforts only gets at part of it.
And I understand that efforts can be interpreted that way to sound only like an action, an actual positive action as opposed to an omission. I understand the distinction. My position on that is... although there are different ways to express the idea, efforts has a cumulative approach where one can look at the efforts of a defendant in a cumulative way. Did he do certain things? Did he fail to do certain things? No different. Again, I'd like to just remind the court of instruction L, which is the standard of care of a defendant. It doesn't say that he has a duty to use a degree of skill and diligence in his efforts or in his omissions, or in his commissions or omissions. It simply states it in a positive way of his duty to do things, not his duty.
Can I interrupt you here for a second to follow up on your answer. The instruction reads, the fact that a doctor's efforts, don't work out, you can't infer negligence. Well, help me with the logic of that. If efforts means just active, proactive, commission negligence, then unless I'm just making a huge conceptual error, this instruction actually helps the plaintiff in a weird way. Because in theory, if you want to read it that way, which is not the way I'm reading it, but that's the way it's being presented, efforts is commission, not omission, then all right, well, the fact that you have a doctor's omissions that cause things not to work out so well, you can infer negligence from that. And that's obviously wrong, but the odd thing about this debate on the word effort seems to me that someone's making a gigantic logical conceptual mistake, because if you read it that way, it actually holds back the principle of law that we're talking about, that accidents don't equal negligence.
Exactly, and precisely in this case, the only allegation against the defendant were acts of omission, if you want to call it an act of omission, but it was three allegations of things he didn't do.
So in theory, a jury could hear this instruction and go, huh, and if they read it the way we're being told we should read it, I guess we can infer negligence because it wasn't an effort issue, it was an omission issue.
I believe a fair reading of the instruction by a jury would be effort includes the things the doctor did and didn't do. I don't believe that one needs to spell out specifically what those efforts were. Or
I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying that if you read it differently, it doesn't hurt the plaintiff.
To me, I believe that this instruction is designed to demonstrate the threshold of evidence needed for the plaintiff to meet their burden of proof. That there is, yes, sir.
I think we can all agree on what the instruction is attempting to do.
Yes.
The question is it confusing or misleading the jury? You just indicated that it's the things that he did and didn't do or attempted to do and didn't do. I'm just looking at the dictionary definition of efforts, and it's a vigorous or determined attempt or the result of an attempt. And that doesn't really square up with what you have just asked us to understand the word to mean.
Well, I think that even the VTLA's list of definitions from Webster's included one of the totality of actions by the person. The totality of things would include those things he did and that he didn't do. I think that in common parlance, when you're considering and judging a doctor's effort, that it was unsuccessful, and in the context of having just sat through a multi-day trial learning what the doctor did and didn't do, which would include the things plaintiff's expert argued he should have done that he never did, the use of the word effort in that context helps the jury understand whatever the doctor's efforts were that were unsuccessful alone doesn't establish negligence. What the goal of the instruction, I understand there's a focus on the word effort, okay, and perhaps the jury instruction can be expressed with different language in some other case, but in this particular case, the use of the expression of the word effort, the doctor's efforts that were unsuccessful, alone doesn't establish negligence, completely comports with the evidence in this case that whether Dr. Nguyen put forth effort that was unsuccessful, the principle of law at issue is that enough that there's negligence? The fact that whatever he did or didn't do was unsuccessful. We know it was unsuccessful. Does that establish negligence, or does the plaintiff have to prove more? So I believe what we're trying to express in this instruction is how much proof under instruction L that the plaintiff has to put on, how much proof of action or inaction is enough for the jury to conclude there was negligence. It's, to me, the threshold statement of outcome is some of the evidence you can use, but it's not enough. You need outcome plus something else.
This was debated in front of the trial judge, was there any objection along the lines of, look, well, you can give the instruction generally, and I get the point, but don't use action or efforts or commission. Use action or inaction, commission or omission.
Right. Your Honor, at page 979 of the joint appendix, the only objection raised by the plaintiff for this instruction was an argument of cumulativeness. It was not that the instruction itself was argumentative. Now, I know it was touched upon, and I have the quote here. It says, It borders on the line of argumentative. But that, in my opinion, is not a contemporaneous objection to the instruction being given.
Is 979 the only objection to this instruction? Is there anything else in the record other than that?
I believe it's the only one. I may be wrong, but I believe it's the only one that was in the transcript.
So the objection is only cumulative. You don't need to say it because it's said in the finding instructions, or at least implied in the finding instructions.
That's correct. That's the only objection that was raised, and indeed it's not cumulative.
Is there any point at all, ever, pre-trial, post-trial, where someone told the trial judge, look, the word efforts is a semantic mistake, really. We need to say efforts or omissions or action or inaction or something that closes the rhetorical loop.
I found no such argument or evidence in the transcript at any point, even in the actual record beyond the appendix. I came up with nothing. I might be shown wrong by my opponent, but to my understanding, page 979, it's one paragraph, it is one objection, and it is cumulativeness.
Let me ask you that. I'm not asking you to concede anything in this case, but from your perspective, is there any problem with the approach a number of these states have taken to offer what the plaintiffs and plaintiffs amicus describe as a more balanced approach? In other words, they begin with a statement of that sort that we have here, maybe slightly different wording, but then they, in addition to that, have some additional language. This is, but if you find that the doctor was negligent or worse to that effect, is there a flaw with that approach from your perspective?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's a flaw with that approach. As I expressed earlier, there are different ways to express the concept, and some might be more comprehensive than others. I believe if one reads the opening brief and the argument plaintiff put forth that in the Brown versus Kouazakis case, this instruction is missing, as I call it, the second sentence. The second sentence being, but it's the degree of skill and diligence that the negligence is judged by. If that's the part that's missing, that part was included in the instructions, just not literally right. The next sentence. So I believe it's comprehensive. These jury instructions were comprehensive and not, there was no abuse of discretion in any of them. However, in other cases, if one were to have a differently written approach, I could see that that would not be error as well.
Courts have a degree of discretion with what to give and not give and how to assemble the complete picture for the jury.
Indeed, if the judge had decided to read instruction L right after instruction M, it would have read just like Brown versus Kouazakis, but that's just not how they chose to read, the court chose to read it. And one is not confined to the model instructions either, so, Your Honor, one could be...
The reality is the model in many courts, probably most courts, becomes the default, and if you wave that around, it generally is accepted, even when, as in this instance, there's some pretty heavily cautionary language in the commentary.
I believe that's correct. I do believe that the manner by which it was used in this case was proper. I would like to take a moment of the
court's...
Would
you address the question?
That's exactly what I'd like to do, Your Honor. Did you have a specific question? Or
I do. The judge said, I'm going to answer this on the basis of the complaint, and he said it's the day of. Well, the complaint said on or about, and there seemed to be some evidence from which the jury could have concluded perhaps low CT myelogram the next day when your expert says within a matter of hours. So help me as to how we definitively tell this jury that it's the day of.
Okay, so the first response I would have, Your Honor, is the trial judge carefully did not say the evidence at trial establishes the negligence would have only happened on February 19th. That is not what he did. What he chose to do is say the lawsuit alleges the negligence occurred on February 19th. Which I think is a prudent move. First of all, it's a style that the Court of Appeals has at least addressed.
But was it accurate? I thought paragraph 6 says on or about.
Right. I'm going to address that in a moment. I just wanted to comment to the Court that I believe it's a stylistic approach that has been approved in the past, but referencing the actual charging document, the lawsuit. But I believe it is accurate, Your Honor. The two paragraphs of the lawsuit that deal with the date do both say on or about. Okay. And if I may, on or about is a stylistic approach in drafting pleadings that is typically used to comment on a particular day and maybe that date is wrong, maybe the evidence will prove that the date is wrong in the future. And so on or about, I believe you will find in every lawsuit, just as a matter of caution. But if you actually read what it actually says in each of those two paragraphs that deal with the date, it's pretty carefully written that it's the surgery itself, which is when the negligence allegedly occurs. On or about February 19, defendant was admitted to an Fairfax hospital where defendant performed surgical revision and replacement of the spinal cord stimulator and replacement of a pulse generator, during the course of which the plaintiff was injured. Okay, during the course of the surgery on the 19th. Paragraph 6 says, the manner in which the defendant performed the surgical procedures upon plaintiff on or about February 19 deviated from the standard of care. So although on or about is used on the date itself, it's not saying on or about this day some negligence happened generally. It's saying on or about that's the date of the month. But it's during the surgical performance that the negligence happened. So if the evidence showed it was actually February 20 that surgery happened, that would be the about part of it. Well, okay, but it's still during the surgery that both paragraphs are focusing their allegation that that's when the negligence occurred. So I believe...
Here's the problem. You just used the term prudence. Frankly, a prudent judge would not have answered this question. I don't know whether it's going to be reversible error or not, but the question shouldn't have been answered, and questions that ignore the red light. The Chief Justice has said you could ignore the red light. While I'm spouting off. And the problem is this. I hear exactly what you're saying about the complaint, but there's a multi-day trial. And during that multi-day trial, they focused on a discrete period of time, I think 6 days in the hospital. And there was no objection raised during the trial saying, wait, Your Honor, this testimony exceeds what is stated in those two paragraphs of the complaint. So the jury was not limited to the complaint. The jury was tasked with taking everything, that not only the complaint, but all of the testimony. And the judge has essentially said, you've got to focus on the complaint. And that's problematic. So please respond to that.
I would be happy to, Your Honor. I'll try to be as brief as I can, understanding the time. In my opinion, if the judge had answered the question, which sometimes happens, rely on the evidence as you have and the jury instructions you've been given, if that was the answer, this jury is encouraged by the specific objective evidence of what we have from the question to look beyond that which the plaintiff's experts testified the actual breach of the standard of care was. Three breaches, all of which happened on or during or on the day of surgery. And we know this because the testimony was that there was a window of hours to accomplish the surgical removal of the implanted device. That's what the result is of doing the CT myelogram. So all breaches had to occur on the day of surgery. If the judge didn't answer this question, if the judge gave the "you have the evidence" answer, okay, it would be unfair to my client because now you have a case where the lawsuit alleged negligence on the surgery day, during the surgery, and you have evidence that only shows negligence and the need to complete the procedure on the day of surgery
but
itself.
But window of hours not being a definitive amount of time. It could be 24 hours. And I don't want to be nitpicky with you. I did say your expert. It was their expert. But window of hours.
Right.
That's
my
a nebulous term.
My point is that if the jury was not told the lawsuit allegation, they could look to weeks later and months later, as their question specifically asks, can we look to months later for negligence? There's no evidence of any negligence months later. The judge needed to confine the jury to what the lawsuit alleged and what the evidence
supported.
That's
why the judge should say, you've got to rely upon the evidence.
And he avoided specifically commenting on the evidence, Your Honor, is I think the fairest approach he took. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Your time has expired. Call the next case.